Generate is supporting my vision to improve the financial literacy of 100,000 Kiwis by sponsoring Keep the Change. Cheers, Generate. Head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/change to find out more. Getting in the KiwiSaver fund that suits you and your situation is key to making sure you're maximising your investment. Generate are an award-winning KiwiSaver provider with a track record of long-term performance, and they can help you do exactly this. Their advisors can meet with you to talk about all your options when it comes to KiwiSaver to help you decide what's best for you. Too many people never get KiwiSaver advice, but not you. Go to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/change to book a no-obligation chat with a Generate advisor. A copy of the product disclosure statement is available at generatekiwisaver.co.nz. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. Welcome back. You are listening to another episode of the Keep the Change podcast. And today we've got a ripper for you, interviewing another Kiwi doing things a little bit differently out there. Aaron, sitting across from me from Keyhook. You might be familiar with Keyhook because we've spoken to Luke from Keyhook before. Mate, good to see you.
Hey, how's it going? I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to digging in and finding out a bit more about how you've got to where you are today and probably showing Kiwis a little bit of a side to life that we can go down, or a pathway that many people probably wouldn't know about.
Yeah, I think I've lived a bit of a different kind of unconventional life to most people, and I hope that maybe the experience resonates with some people.
Now, a lot of people, or some people, let's not say a lot, mate, you know, some may not have listened to the first episode with you lads from Keyhook. Just do you want to give us a quick insight as to what Keyhook does to bring people up to speed if they didn't go and listen to that?
Sure. Basically, at Keyhook, we're trying to flip the property management model on its head. We believe that there's a better, smarter, easier way to do anything tenancy related in New Zealand and soon the rest of the world. And so we just use we make use of modern technology to automate most of the rental life cycle. And in doing so, everything just ends up being a lot easier and better for both landlords and tenants.
Wicked. So that's both the property owner and the tenant.
Yes. Yep. And even for a few of our customers, it's property managers too.
Okay, cool. So basically, instead of, it's a software that me as a property owner, say, that rents it out, can then use to collect my tenancy agreement, like everything, right?
Yeah. For a lot of people, I think it's even hard to imagine because we're so used to just a tenancy being a lease on a piece of paper that you've had to scan, print, scan, sign, and just go through this ordeal.
I just signed one, mate. I've just been through this process. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. We just believe, why are we doing this? Mm. Why? We have apps for everything that just improve our life and make everything so convenient. Why don't we have this for tenancy? And so that's what we built. So everything is done through your phone or through your computer. It's all there. It's transparent. Everyone is always clued in as to what's happening, and everything is always just done at a click of a button.
How is Keyhook going for those people who would be interested that did listen to the first podcast?
Yeah, it's been a hell of a year since Luke was on the podcast. We have continued to grow month on month, and we've the team has grown. Our user base has grown. We've got thousands upon thousands of users all around New Zealand, from the top of the North Island to the bottom of the South Island, which is awesome.
Yeah.
We're close to expanding into Australia. We've had companies and organizations over there reach out to us and say, hey, we love what you're doing. Please bring Keyhook to to Australia. Wow. And we're getting those agreements in place, and hopefully later this year we'll be breaking first steps into Australia.
Sheesh, that's exciting. And I suppose that's something that I spoke to Luke about on the pod, is that you boys have always had a vision to be global and be bigger than just New Zealand, right?
Yep, that's always been from day one. I built most of Keyhook, and I built it right from the beginning that New Zealand's just a piece of the puzzle. It's never the end and be all. It's just one small piece, and we believe that, it's only the first stop. There's every other country we're coming for.
Wow. All right. Well, that's a good segue, mate. How does one go about building the biggest property manager in the world?
A lot of hard work, I'll say that. It's one of those things, I think Luke brought it up, but we started off with a piece of the puzzle, which was inspections. And we wanted to improve inspections. And then we realized, hey, landlords actually want the whole pie. They want anything to do with their tenancy. If they're going to pay for software, they want it to be done with one thing. So we went to market. We worked out what do our customers need. We had so many user interviews and we kept building and building. And slowly it just turned into this entire encompassing platform that just covers everything from signing a lease right through to maintaining your property, to inspections, to collecting rent. Everything that kind of got involved just started to have to be built, and so we built it.
I'm a pretty simple guy, mate, and I can't build much, apart from audiences. I go right at that. But how do you know how to build an app? Like, how does that happen? What did you study at school?
So I didn't, really. I did 1 year of university, and I hated it. Wow. I'm going to say this, and I think university in New Zealand kind of sucked.
Oh, sucked or sucks?
Might still do, but I think just I have been building websites and companies since I was 13. So when I went to university, I kind of already knew a lot of what is being used in the market, what you actually need to know to have a job, and they weren't teaching that. Yeah. And when I tried to ask my lecturers, hey, like, can I go a bit above and beyond on this paper? I'm really enjoying building this. Can I try to do some more? And they're like, nah, just kind of stick to the outline, just do what the paper says. And that just killed my motivation. There was a whole mindset of C's get degrees, and that wasn't good enough for me. So I said, screw it. I found this program in San Francisco, and I dropped out of university, and I think I got my visa, and within 2 weeks, I was in San Francisco learning to code over there.
Sheesh. So you kind of knew that this was an area you were interested in and you wanted to scratch the itch.
Yeah, I'd always been, whenever I was building stuff when I was younger, I had been on more of the business side and I always had to hire developers. And I kind of got a bit sick of having to hire people. It was really cool at like 13 to be running a team of developers doing stuff. But I just knew I quite enjoy building things and I quite enjoy being on the technical side. I want to learn how to do that side.
Yeah.
And we're better to go than in Silicon Valley.
Well, before we get to Silicon Valley, how does someone at the age of 13 be building out businesses and hiring people?
Yeah, this is a funny story, and I think the statute of limitations shouldn't get me anymore. But back when everyone was playing like online games like World of Warcraft, me and my friends would all do that, but my parents wouldn't allow me to pay for a subscription for World of Warcraft. So I was like, oh, all my friends are playing it, I want to play it, I'm not allowed. But there's a way to be able to play it for free if you run your own servers. And it's kind of like running a copied version of the game on your own server. And so I did that. Yeah. And it taught me how to build websites, how to like run databases. And we had this private server running off my family computer downstairs.
Yeah.
That thousands of people around the world were all connecting to and playing from.
Shit.
And we'd have situations where the server would go down because my brothers turned off the computer and I'd have to like rush home from school in order to turn it back on because like some people would be paying us for this.
Wow.
So I had some developers working for me. I was managing that, and that it all branched out from there. And from there, like, I learned how to build websites. I'd buy websites and sell them. I was running a lot of online communities, which was really cool. I think there was just this glorious period of the internet where forums existed, and a lot of people would look for these communities that have now kind of been replaced by Reddit.
Yeah.
But there was so much knowledge to be learned from them and so much that you could learn from other people and just be exposed to all sorts of like marketing, development. This whole new like industry was being built on the internet, and a lot of the people there were just on the forefront of it, and it was a really cool thing, you know, at the age of 14, 15 to be learning about.
Yeah. Were you still smacking through school life and you were getting, like, you were passing everything?
Yeah, to some degree. Some subjects I did great in because I loved it. Some I was like, I can't be bothered. Mm. I had my computer at school and I like had to go log into the computer labs often and try run my business from there. but it was also just like a lot of things took a hit. I stopped showing up to sports practices, and I know a lot of my friends there kind of hated me because I never turned up to games.
Yeah.
just because there was no time. Like, it is one of those things that just kind of drags you in, but it was so much fun.
And what did your parents think about all of this at the time? Or they're probably like, why are we using so much power downstairs? Yeah. Is that how it works?
I always say this, like, my dad is one of my biggest supporters, and it's like a real shout out to him, because I don't think I would be where I am today without the support that he gave me. And so when I was young, he saw what I was doing, and he was like, yep, this is something. I'm going to just support Aaron wherever I can. So he invested a little bit into me to try help when, like, he saw that I was starting to make money, and he's like, I'll invest in. I lost quite a bit of money when I was young because I was young and stupid. He didn't care. He was like, you've learned something. Awesome. That's what matters. And so he backed me a lot, which was really cool. I mean, they always wanted to make sure that I stayed on top of my grades and my and with school. They weren't too happy when I dropped out of university, but they came around on it when they saw what I was doing.
How good's having a supportive parent or just somebody supportive in general in your life?
I think it makes a huge difference. I don't know if I'd, like I said, be where I am today without that support.
Yeah, it's awesome. Okay, so you get through school and stuff. You're obviously well into this now. You're absolutely loving it, and you've found something that obviously lights you up. So you've been uni after a year, and you go to San Fran. So what does San Fran look like? What are you going there for and doing?
Yeah, so back then, this new thing had just come out, and these were coding boot camps. And the idea was, in 2 months, they will teach you everything that you need to learn in order to get an entry-level job software developing. And the one that I went to, they said, you don't have to pay us anything. What we'll do is, if you graduate from our course, then you only have to pay us when you get your first job making over $80,000 US
per
year, and we'll take 20% of your first year salary.
So,
and that was 10 years ago.
Oh, wow. So 80K US, we're looking at like 140K New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then 10 years ago, so it's probably about the equivalent of $354 million New Zealand now.
Yeah.
That's obviously a lot of money. And what age would you have been?
I was 19.
You were 19.
I worked out a really cool deal with them. They were like incredibly nice people where because I didn't have a visa to be able to work over there, they said, hey, why don't you come and intern for the first course? And if you do that, we'll give you the course for free in our second one. And then I ended up being one of the top students. So they asked me to stay on and be a teacher there. So I ended up teaching people how to code for a while, which is really interesting because I was 19 and some of my students were like 25, 30, 40 with like PhDs and masters and things. So it was quite an interesting experience having to ask your students to buy you beer.
Yeah.
But it was a hell of a time. And that was just kind of the tip of the iceberg of me being out there.
Yeah. I saw a cool saying recently, and I'd never even really seen this until my 30s, but basically you never really learn something until you can teach it.
I think that's very true. There's a lot of concepts that start to be solidified when you then have to work out, how do I explain this to someone else?
Mm.
And when you actually start to do that, you really understand it at a, like, its most basic level, which is kind of what you need to be able to do, especially a lot of software development is breaking things down and into smaller pieces and working out where do those pieces actually lie and how do you go one level lower.
Okay, so San Fran 2014-ish, how many other Kiwis are going and doing something like this?
I can't think of any back then. I was a bit of a novelty out there. I do remember whenever someone would talk to me like, you're 19 and you're from New Zealand? Like, do you know Flight of the Conchords? That was kind of the extent of it, but no one had really met someone from New Zealand, which was just really, you know, there was the one or two New Zealanders they might be able to point to in the media, Lord of the Rings, that was all they knew. And so it was really cool, but it was also, I think it worked in my favor a lot because it opened up a lot of doors of people just wanting to talk to me because it was a bit of an interesting story about, hey, this 19-year-old just moved over here and he's like, he's doing all these things. Have you talked to him? And so it opened some cool doors, which was really cool.
Yeah. Wow. And were you not like scared because you didn't know anyone or worried about where you'd stay and stuff? Were you just young and didn't have fear or what?
I think I had jumped into the metaphorical deep end without knowing it. I stayed in an area of San Francisco in my first month called the Tenderloin. And despite the name, it's not very tender.
Okay.
Just at night, I was in student housing. And at night, you would hear like drug addicts running around outside. You'd hear gunshots. It's the worst part of San Francisco by large. And I think even it's an area where police just kind of ignore now because they just, it's like a designated crime zone almost.
Shit.
And I had no idea. And, you know, 19-year-old me, I was a skinny little stick figure back then.
Yeah.
and I was living there, and it was quite the culture shock. You know, I saw more homeless people on one street corner than I did my entire life growing up in New Zealand. So there was just a huge culture shock initially, but I think that the city is full of so many friendly, like-minded people that I then fit in quite well. And as soon as I moved away from there and got into an apartment in a nicer area of the city, it was just 10 times better experience. And I ended up just loving San Francisco.
Yeah. There'd be a lot of people, mate, that don't even understand what learning to develop or write code and stuff is. So for people like myself, what are you actually learning? Is it the, you explain in simple terms.
Yeah, it's really wide because there are so many different ways that you can write code or what you want to do. Do you want to build a website? Do you want to build a mobile app? Do you want to just run software that runs in a data somewhere that's, you know, powering a server or something? There's like all these different facets that you can kind of go into, and it's just, what are you interested in? But we live in the wonderful age of the internet where you can just start learning online. And so there's different steps to it, but you first start by learning a programming language. And so that's the language that you're going to write code in. It's one of those things where I think people get too attached to what language they might learn. And you can, once you know one, you can learn another and you can know another. I think I know about 8 or 9 now because you just pick them up and anything you need to know, you just Google.
Yeah. So you can spot a language very quickly, whereas I'd probably just think, what the hell is that? It's just like any language, right? I wouldn't even know what it is.
Yeah. You pretty much can. And like the file that it's in will tell you what language it is. But in general, they have different syntaxes. Yeah. That then determine how they're written.
I just built a landing page today, for instance, but do it in, even an accountant can do it. So it's just images and stuff, and I drag and drop, and then at the end, it's like, do you want the code? I'm like, fuck no. I'm like, no, I just want to make sure that it works. Give me the link so I can then go and put it into Google Chrome and click on that and see, does it load up all good?
Yeah, exactly. That's the beauty of software, though, is that there are people writing software to make writing software easier.
Yeah.
And so that's just part of the whole thing, and it makes it like there's tools for developers that make writing code a lot easier, and there's a whole industry based around that too, as well as a whole industry around people who have no technical experience whatsoever, and how do we enable them to be able to build what they need to be able to build too.
Okay, so you're in San Fran, you're kicking ass, you dodging the drug scene and the homeless people and all sorts of shit going on in the tenderloin space that I thought was reserved for chicken. But you're then teaching it as well because you're obviously learning it to the extent where you can then reteach it. And then what happens from there?
Yeah, so I ended up moving into what's called a hacker house. I know basically no one will understand what that is. If anyone's watched the TV show Silicon Valley.
So you moved in with Kim.com. Sorry.
It's very similar to that. In which it was one property with 13 guys, a couple of women living in there too. But if you imagine living with 13 guys, it's an interesting experience. Mm. But basically everyone in there is all involved in tech in some way. Most people are programmers, some people on the business side. Some people basically are living in closets that have bunk beds in them, just because if you think New Zealand has a rent problem, San Francisco and Silicon Valley is like 10 times worse.
Living in a closet in bunk beds.
Essentially, yeah.
Wow.
So I was sharing a room back then, paying for the room $1,800 US. And that was, you know, in a house full of 13 other people. But it was one of the best experiences of my life. Everyone there was so awesome to be around. There was this collective mindset of, if everyone's doing something exciting, how can we help each other? How can we help what Aaron's building on, and what can I do to help you? We had a lot of parties because we're all young, and it was kind of funny that we had this rundown house, and then one block away, Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, was living. Zuckerberg was another block away. CEO of Yahoo was a block away. Like, all these big CEOs were all around us. And then there was just our house that was often getting the cops called on us because we're having a huge, you know, 100-person party.
Wow. Yeah. And Zuckerberg and whatnot, I guess by this stage, they're all doing pretty well and stuff like that, right? 10 years ago, they must have been some pretty grunty places. And so the people that you were living with, what were you all working on? Were you in jobs at this stage, or what does it look like?
Yeah, a lot of people were self-employed working on their own companies. I was not able to work back then, so I was kind of working on my own projects too. There were some people employed at, you know, companies like Google and other startups and stuff around the area, but everyone was pretty much all involved in tech. it was a wide kind of net of what people were working on. I had one friend and she was building a company that basically did lunch catering to startups. So just making it incredibly easy to feed your staff and have them all have their lunch. Whereas there was also some people working on courses for teaching programming. There was, what was one of the other really cool ones? There was someone who was basically building an app that was like Spotify for Tinder, or Tinder for Spotify, however you want to look at it. It's like basically an easy app to be able to find new music by swiping through it.
Gotcha.
So everyone just had really varied ideas, and it was just an interesting experience being surrounded by everyone who is waking up first thing in the morning, wanting to hustle, wanting to just do whatever they can to try grow their company.
Yeah, so you're trying to build something to then sell it as such, or like that idea, for instance, do you then try and build it to then go and show people, hey, look, you know, you can swipe left or right to get your next favorite song, or?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think they have the next big idea, really. Yeah. And so it's you build something, you get users, you get customers, you get investment, you turn it into a bigger company. And from there, you know, does the company make money or not? It's all to be determined. But back then, there was a lot more venture capital flowing. And so even off a smaller idea, you could get investment and start to like turn your idea, your small proof of concept into a bigger company and have employees and everything.
So just for, because it's not very common here, right, but how that would work is Luke's got an idea, I build it out just in a high level format so that I can go and talk to people about it, and someone with capital, so money, I'd say to them, do you want to invest into that? And they would take a percentage of my business and say, here you go, this is going to keep you paying your rent in the party house, start building it out, and then you need to prove that you can turn it into a business.
Yeah, exactly.
That'll give you some cash to hire developers and stuff like that as well.
Exactly. And I think often when you're doing deals like that, they'll often take things like a board seat, which gives them a say in how you run your company too.
I see. Okay, so they're a director kind of thing on the board. Yeah. So you go back to them and say, right, now we think we're going to do this. And they would say, well, actually, have you considered this?
Yeah, exactly. If they're going to give you, you know, anywhere from a couple hundred thousand to a couple million dollars for a percentage of your company, they're going to want to say in what you do with that money.
And there's plenty of this cash must just go up in thin air, right?
Because, 100%.
Yeah.
I believe it's something like 80% of startups fail.
Yeah.
And so most of that money just ends up, you know, vanishing. I mean, it gets paid out to people and, you know, there's a whole flow on effect. But in general, most companies are going to fail. And, you know, I've failed several times, but there's plenty of successes too. And it's those successes that venture capital companies are banking on, because when they succeed hard and you get multi-billion dollar companies.
It's kind of interesting where it's almost the reverse of New Zealand, right? Where we'll try and decrease our risk and go, what's the safest thing to put money in? Normally housing for most people, whereas over there it sounds like they are looking for 100 to 200x multiples and stuff, and they know that they'll lose some cash along the way, but they know if they just stay consistent, they find the one, then they will get the money back. But it seems to be encouraged in America compared to New Zealand. Did you experience that?
I 100% did. I think there's a completely different mindset to New Zealand. New Zealand has a very conservative investment mindset. And over there, it was just take a chance. Take a chance on yourself and take a chance on others, because the dream is to build something big. I mean, America has a lot of problems. Like, I'm not going to deny that. But one thing they do really well is this goal of wanting to build something yourself and wanting to succeed by building business.
Yeah. And you can just feel it when you go over there too. I mean, I haven't spent heaps of time there, but they just seem really encouraging and supportive, and they just literally think that their country is the best thing ever and that they're just, you know, capable of so much.
Yeah, they really have a different mindset, and I found it infectious when I was over there just to have such a support net, almost like you felt it in the air, this excitement about what's the next big company? What's being built? Everyone wants to know, like, companies throw these big parties out there just to attract the best employees, and they offer these insane perks. It's who can build the best thing and how can we help each other to build the best thing? And that was such an interesting mindset that everyone was excited to hear about what you're doing. I think I grew up in New Zealand where you know, I was doing this stuff when I was young and no one cared. No. It kind of got
probably
ignored.
Thought you were weird.
Yeah, 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 exactly. There's Aaron off on his computer. No one really cares.
Yeah, there's something wrong with him.
Yeah. Probably what something was. Yeah. But no one really cared. Yeah. And it's just, and even now I think people don't care as much about business in New Zealand. We're getting better and there's definitely a lot more ecosystems for startups and companies, and I really love that that's happening. And it's awesome that we try to that people are trying to encourage that. And I think in general, we should be trying to encourage it as much as possible. But over there, it's just a whole nother level of how do we support people? How do we give them the tools that they need to be able to build something and succeed?
Do you think the driver over there, they're trying to make a lot of money, or are they're trying to build something big, or they're trying to help a lot of people? What was the common theme with this sort of stuff?
I think it's kind of, it depends on who you are over there.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of people like me, maybe who are more on the tech side of things, you just want to build something big. They're like, it's that kind of, there's a problem to be solved and we want to solve it. We want to work out how do we architect the solution to this problem, and it's how do we make it as big and like beautiful as possible almost. It kind of becomes of like, you almost want to have your name on a skyscraper, but skyscrapers these days are big code bases. Right? These big platforms powering a lot of what we do on the internet. Where no doubt there's a bunch of people there who are in it for the money, and I'm not going to like pretend that I'm not in it for money too. Like the dream is to hopefully be able to make a lot of money one day and live a good life with that money. But I think there's people coming at it with different angles.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything realistically comes back to money in some form or shape, and it's very easy for us to pretend that's not happening. I think it's easier to do that when we don't make much money, because then we can basically prove, well, it's not about the money because we don't have much. But when you can start to see what's possible, then it's pretty hard to not be impacted or, you know, led by that in some way. But it's a really cool analogy you talk about. Instead of trying to have the building with the name on it, you basically, it's the same thing, but in the internet version, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think people realize just how much man hours go into building things like that we use every day. Like the scale of something like Uber and how that works to track, you know, millions of cars around the road all over the world is just phenomenal. Even something like Twitter, the amount of effort that you have to go in to be able to support many, like millions upon millions tweeting something at the same time is just some of the like hardest problems that like humans have had to solve. It's crazy the amount of effort that has to go into solving how you do all these things and do it cost efficiently.
I got Uber yesterday because they keep giving me these $20 off at grocery stores, and I think they're trying to advertise the fact that they're doing grocery stuff. But I could see the dude, not see him, but I could, it would show me that he was picking the items that I was asking for at the Foursquare.
Yeah.
It was like, that's now in the cart. I'm like, and it was like ticking it off. And then this, do you want to replace that with something else? It's like, holy shit, this is interactive now.
Yeah. And it's crazy because you almost think, well, do I need to know that?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, so long as it's on its way. But, you know, someone built that. Mm. And if it's happening for you, it's happening for potentially thousands of other people just around New Zealand, let alone, you know, around the world.
Yeah, it's awesome. It is. I think it's very easy to take technology for granted because a lot of us don't have a good understanding. Like often when I go to events, for instance, I'll look at the business side of it and I'll just get caught up thinking like, oh, I wonder, oh, how do they get them as a sponsor? And like, oh, I wonder why we're walking through this entrance and, oh, look at what they gave us on the way out and stuff like that. Whereas you must use things and be like, oh, shit, I know how they've built this, or that's a good feature, or your mind must just constantly be going with technology.
Yeah, so that's one thing that actually really got me into software development was you start using this stuff and you're like, I wonder how it works. Mm. And there's that kind of mindset. I always say that like whenever I'm looking to hire people, especially developers, it's anyone who's ever muttered the sentence, I wonder how that works, and then goes and tries to look for it. Because those people end up being, in my opinion, some of the best software developers because you look to understand, like not just on a surface level, but I want to go deeper. How is it actually working? Can I build this myself? And that drive often translates into really good like ability to be able to build products. But yeah, it's just, I think a lot of people don't actually understand how much goes into some of this stuff. Even if we look at, for example, the Keyhook platform, there's millions upon millions of lines of code now that run Keyhook. And, you know, we're still getting started, right? We're still in currently only New Zealand, and we're about to go overseas and things, but that's just to power something in New Zealand, the amount of work that goes into that.
Someone has to write that code.
Yep. So by and large, a lot of our initial product was me. Yep. And then now we have other developers building alongside me, which is really welcome. Helpful. And
yeah,
it's really nice to have, but often it means that it's too much for just one person to have in their head, right? Like often when I get asked a question by my co-founder Luke, sometimes I have to ask another team member to work out what part of the code base that's in and to look it up, or I have to go looking because it's something that I wrote a year ago and I need to refresh my memory, because it's just, imagine writing like the entire Harry Potter book set and then being asked what happened on page 3 of the second book.
You're like, yeah, about that. I was going to ask you, what about ChatGPT? What's that done? But let's park that, because let's just go back to San Fran. Mm-hmm. And you said you had, you know, a number of failures or failings that have then led to lessons. But take us through a little bit more of that stage of your life. So you are, you're not able to work, I think you said, and so, but you're still building things and you're helping other people. And then what happens?
So I ended up having to move back to New Zealand after 2 years, just because I couldn't stay out there any longer visa-wise. But luckily I was approached by a friend I met in the Hacker House. He had a mentor who was actually, one of the business partners of Lady Gaga.
Wow.
And they were building a product and they wanted me to come on board to run the development side of it. So that's where I started my first company, and I started that alongside those two. And we built what was at the time the biggest custom news app on iPhone. So if you imagine your standard news app, you follow politics, tech, sport, you know, those kind of set categories. We let you follow anything you wanted to. So, you know, as someone, for example, like yourself, you might pop up in the news, you might want to keep your own name on and know anytime you're mentioned in the news or any article or blog or anything. But even, you know, like your favorite TV show, your favorite athlete, back then that was actually one of the things that really spiked the use of our app was, I think it was the Paris terrorist attacks, and people wanted to follow the latest news on what was happening there. So our app got used heavily for that. And so we were the one of the biggest on iPhone to be able to do that, and no one else was really doing that, and that was before, you know, Apple News, Google News and those kinds of platforms.
Sheesh. Okay. And did you exit that company? That your first exit?
Yep. So that was, we started building that when I was 21. I sold that when I was 23 to a big tech company called Meltwater. And so that was an awesome experience to kind of have under my belt, that I've, you know, sold my first company at 23. I was really excited about that, and it was a lot of validation, an awesome thing to be able to have done, yeah.
That would have been a pretty grunty process to go through, no doubt.
There's a lot. I don't think people, it was an eye-opener for me, and I don't think a lot of people realize what actually gets involved with selling a company, but the amount of due diligence that anyone buying you will do is just enormous, especially a software project. They're going to have to go through all of your code, make sure that you're not using anything that you're not allowed to. There's a lot of legal compliance that just goes into it. So just even selling it took months upon months of back and forth and working with their teams in order to be able to approve it.
Wow. And was it a decent payday for you when it was done?
Yeah, I'm very fortunate with what I came out with. I'm not allowed to talk about the amounts that we sold the company for, but it was a good exit, especially at 23.
And, I was going to say, so at 23, was it an amount of money where you're like, well, fuck, what is life?
Amount, but like I was fortunate enough to basically be able to buy my first home at 26.
Wow.
Without a mortgage.
Nice.
That's the best way of putting it. Not enough to retire, but you know, it was definitely set me up for life quite well, I think.
Yeah, well done, mate. Okay, so 23, and then what do you do from there? Because I'd imagine someone like you want to build shit, so you're like, well, that was great, but now I've sold the thing I was building, so let's build some more shit.
Yeah, so I had to work for Meltwater for a while, just the way that the contracts went, that we ended up, you know, we had to transition everything over to them, and then we were working for them for a while. But if I'm being honest, I hated working for a big company. There's just so much bureaucracy and like office politics and things that gets involved, that it wasn't for me. And at the time, my co-founder, who I started Algo, which was that news app with, he approached me about, hey, let's do something. Again, I've been approached by someone else and there's an awesome opportunity here. Let's do it. So I jumped ship and we started what was our next company called DeltaSift. And we basically saw the need for, this was in the day and age where Facebook ads were just going off. Everyone was pouring so much money into them and they were driving so many results. But we can do this better because we can make use of AI and machine learning to improve everyone's campaigns.
How many years ago was this? Sorry.
Would that be? Yeah, somewhere around 2017.
Okay, so you're already looking at AI and stuff like that in 2017.
Yeah.
And people like me are just like, fucking hell, look at ChatGPT in 2023. This is amazing. This must have just happened.
Yeah, so even back then when we first started Algo, that was actually an AI company. We were using machine learning and AI to do a lot of the news things that we were doing in order to process that amount of news and work out and categorize everything and work out what is this news article actually about. There's a lot of kind of back-end algorithms that went into that. But yeah, with DeltaSif, we started out with this goal of how do we do that. It kind of turned more into a bit of an advertising agency, and we represented like millions upon millions of dollars of ad spend with some huge companies out there.
Wow.
But I kind of wanted to be more involved in the tech side. We had this vision of, you know, using machine learning to do all these things, and it kind of wasn't going where I wanted to. And so that's when I actually got approached by Luke to do Keyhook. And I was like, you know what? This is the right time, right place. We can do this. Let's do it.
So did you then sell out of that, is it DeltaSif?
Yeah. So I sold out. My co-founders did an awesome job with the rest of the company and managed to then have it sell off pretty soon after for quite a high amount, which is awesome. And I'm still, you know, best friends with Evan, who I started both Algo and DeltaSif, where he's like a brother to me, basically.
Wow.
And yeah, it's been just all go since then as well with Keyhook too. So Keyhook, kind of my third official company, but there's been a few in between as well.
So you get a gain out of that sale as well? That's profitable.
Not a huge amount.
Okay, that's right. I'm just trying to figure out, showing what's possible rather than just, things that people wouldn't think about. Okay, so Luke, you had known since you were a young fella at kindy, I believe, right?
Yep, since kindergarten. Best friend since then, which has been an interesting wild ride, yeah.
Yeah, and so he can see this opportunity and then he's got a good mate like you and he's like, mate, can we actually build this? Is it possible? I'd imagine the convo goes something like that.
Yeah, he thought it could be built, but he was like, I don't know the first thing about where we start. And I was basically like, yep, just, we can do this.
Yeah.
Just tell me what we need to build and I'll build it.
Fuck.
And we kind of then, you know, brainstormed out and it took on, you know, a bigger life of its own than we thought it would.
Mm.
But it ended up being this huge platform that spun out of, you know, a dinner at a Mexican restaurant one night.
Sheesh. So you can see how to build it. And then I'd imagine you then know what sort of resources that you're going to need and developers, and you're thinking further down the line of basically, right, if this thing starts taking off, then you're going to need people and all sorts of things like that. So could you sort of see all of that from the start?
Yeah, I think so. You get to a point once you've done a few companies where you kind of like, you know what you don't know, and then you start to know what you actually need to know, kind of thing. And so having done this a couple of times, I've known just what kind of resources are going to go in. I know how much I can do by myself, and staff will always be your biggest expense when you're starting a startup. So we tried to delay it as long as possible because we wanted to stay lean. We didn't want to be spending all this money when we didn't need to. So I think I worked for about a year and a half with no pay, basically, before we raised investment. Where I was just living off savings in order to build the first version of the product that we needed.
Yeah. And then you could take it out to investors much like, and you would have had experience doing that over in the States.
Yeah.
So wouldn't the filters unnatural for you?
Not really, no. And having like a previous acquisition on my resume, I guess, was a, you know, nice big green check to be able to show off to investors to at least show he knows what he's doing to some degree and he's got this experience.
Like the Kiwi from Silicon Valley is back, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, that's exciting. Okay, so then you guys go and get some funding and whatnot, and then you carry the build because you're nearly at year four, right? Fourth birthday is coming up maybe in a few months. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Which is crazy to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, sneaks up on you, right?
Okay, yeah, so it really does.
First year, you're probably head down, not getting paid anything and just absolutely grinding, and then you start bringing on investors and team and whatnot.
So we started to expand the team. It was a bit smaller then, and even then, with, you know, the seed round of investment that we raised, it's not a huge amount that we can go out spending it just willy-nilly. Yeah, exactly. So we're quite conservative of where we tried to spend our money. I think Luke brought up that we didn't start marketing for quite a while, but that's also because we wanted to ensure we've got a platform that touches people's money. We wanted to make sure that your money is in safe hands.
Yeah.
That we, like, our platform runs smoothly and there's not going to be any hiccups when it comes to, like, processing rent and things.
Cool. Okay. And so what's this last couple of years been like? Because it feels like from what I've seen, you boys have sort of validated it. You've got buy-in from people wanting to invest. It's probably flipped the other way now. People are probably trying to bring money to you and say, hey, can we get in on this, right?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. When your primary customer base is investors to some degree, we've had a lot of our customers actually approach us and be like, hey, can we invest?
Yeah.
Because they've seen how great the product is and they want to get in on it, which is awesome. But yeah, it's just ramping up. That's kind of what we are now doing. I think Luke mentioned we didn't know when to double down.
Yeah.
And now we know to double down. Now we know we have something awesome on our hands and that it's making a big difference in New Zealand, at least for the customers that are using it, which, you know, is increasing every day, which is just awesome to see.
So what's the biggest pain point or roadblock for you guys at the moment? Like, what are you bashing down the door on?
So it's just having more staff. Yeah. I think like each one of our staff members has so much on their to-do list that we're always looking to hire. But as I said, you know, staff is an expense that like just costs a lot to the business. So we have to be quite strategic about how we hire people. Mm. So it's a matter of balancing that, of how fast do we grow, because you don't want to take on too many expenses. And then with this uncertainty in the market around investment, if, you know, there's any delays in our next investment round, it could mean that we couldn't meet payroll or something. Like, we don't want to put ourselves in that position, because we have a strong mindset that, hey, our staff have taken a chance on us. You know, we give them equity in the company and things, but they've taken a chance on us and we're responsible for them. And I feel a great kind of like pressure and
responsibility
to make sure, hey, they have a paycheck every week and we're doing everything that we can so that they have a great work experience.
Yeah.
So we want to make sure that we don't bring on too many people and then water that down.
Can't give out financial advice on this, mate, but just out of interest, when's the next fucking investment round?
Hopefully at the end of this year, we're looking to raise our next round, and that should hopefully be a pretty big round to just take us overseas properly and really scale this thing out.
Good on you. And do you go to your database of prior investors plus people using the platform and stuff? Like, how do you attack that for those that, you know, don't have much insight into that?
Yeah, so we had an agreement with our initial investors that whenever further investment rounds come out, they always get first rights to any future shares. So they will, of course, get those first rights to them. But we're now working with investment advisors to basically go out to a wider market and to really start knocking on the doors of some bigger investors. So we're looking at venture capital funds, and we really want to try raise a fair bit so that we can do what we want to do, which, you know, is power anything tenancy related.
Can I give you some brackets of numbers, and you, or can you just say like how much you're looking to raise?
Several million dollars.
Okay.
We don't have an exact number, but it's on the magnitude of, you know, millions.
Millions. Yeah. Nice. Scary stuff. You know, most people would try and raise $500,000 from the bank to buy their house at some stage in their life, but you guys are going out there trying to, and I'm sure you'll do it as well, pull together $7 million. It must be a bit frustrating going from being in that sort of Silicon Valley environment where it was probably shit, it's easy to get money, to coming back to New Zealand. You're in a conservative landscape and now the economy's turned down as well, going, holy shit, like, we're going to have to try and get some money out of these people's pockets.
Yeah, 100%. Even in Silicon Valley at the moment, I think the money tap has stopped flowing as much because the market's, you know, tanked a fair bit. And so now there is a more deeper need to prove your business before you can get investment. So you have to prove revenue. You can't just be saying that you're growing and you're getting users. You need to show that you can drive revenue, and you need to be able to show that this business can have legs and that it could support itself one day as well as make a lot of profit. You can't just say, well, users are using it. You need to have that proof there.
And the appealing thing about tech businesses, often from what I understand, and you would have more experience than I on this, mate, but they're usually monthly or recurring forms of income, and that gives investors and people a lot of certainty of what they're buying into, right? Compared to, you know, Sally down the road who's doing some signage for people's offices, and they might do a big project 1 month and then not have any the next month, and then the following month they get a tap on the shoulder again, and that stuff's scary. So.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, software as a service is the big thing, and it's for that exact reason, because you have certainty of your monthly recurring revenue, or if you want to go annually. But, you know, it wasn't always that case. When we were growing up, you bought software once and you had a license for it and you just use it. It's only been in this past, you know, 5-10 years that software as a service has really blown up and been the thing that kind of takes over now.
Yeah.
But it's also that tech is a lot easier to scale. For us to go to Australia, we don't have to open up any physical locations. You know, we might have an office, but we wouldn't have to. And it's a lot easier to then scale out to other countries and to grow your customer base with tech, because it, by nature, you know, the internet is a worldwide thing. It doesn't rely on brick and mortar stores that you then have to worry about, you know, staffing out and renting a building, and all those are huge expenses. It's a lot cheaper and more efficient to be able to, it works in Australia now. We've built it out. And
this could be one of the hardest questions you ever answer in your career, mate. But for me, the other day I was watching on TV and I saw a Tesla in Monaco. And I'm thinking, fuck, I've got a Tesla in New Zealand. Who figures out what side of the road that drives on, writes the code and stuff for that? Do they just know how to do that? Or do they kind of go, right, someone's gone before us, we can figure that out? Because that just blows my mind. When I start thinking, shit, these Teslas are in every country, but every system works differently, and it doesn't know like when to stop, and it's in a different language and all that stuff.
Yeah, so it's kind of actually similar to what we do with Keyhook, right? Tenancy law changes country by country, even state by state, on and countries of states, right? So you will have to build that in, and each time you want to expand out, you do have to build that in, and you have to work it out. You might have to deal with lawyers, you might have to deal with, you know, experts in the area for that country of what are all the small things that you might know about, might need to know about. For Tesla, I would imagine there's a lot of basically having to code in the road rules for that area, yeah, and know, like, what do street signs look like?
Mm.
How are they different to stop signs and everything? So you have to build that in because every country is so different. So there's a lot of work that does go into that, and that's the flip side of these types of things that might deal with laws or compliance in some way, is just that when you do want to scale out, you have to take into account that you have to build those, just the code that that works with those laws.
Yeah, because it would just be never ending, right? But I guess the good thing with tech is that you can go in there and you can update it quite quickly. So if you forgot a law, or sorry, didn't know about a law, and then you're soon going to get in trouble and find out, and then you can build it quite quickly.
You would hope so. Yeah. Can you imagine you forget to, you know, flip the what side of the road does this car drive on option, and you've got some problems on your hands.
Jeez, man, I don't know how you guys do it. That stuff's technical. Hey, quickly, mate, what's the go with AI and this sort of stuff? You know, it's become really big, and I'd imagine that, you know, even if people like me are talking about it, and I'm using ChatGPT and I'm telling you about something before we jumped on the mic of basically what's possible in my space now, where's all of that going, do you think? And yeah, what are your general thoughts on AI and that sort of stuff?
I genuinely think AI is going to be one of the biggest impacts to a lot of people in all industries. And I don't think a lot of people realize just how much it can help them even today, but a few years down the line, what we're going to get to is just crazy. We have an AI product at the moment that's Tama, the expert who can answer any tenancy questions. But in general, it's one of those things where there's a lot of discussion around how much is AI going to replace people and what jobs will it replace. But I think people don't also understand or talk about the fact that it's also like a supplementary technology. It's one of those things where when computers first came in, we often talked about, you know, what jobs are computers going to replace? But then how many jobs did computers create?
Yeah.
And now we have so many industries and jobs that are created on it. And it's like, if you try to apply for an office job and you don't know how to use a computer, you're not going to get that job, right? So I think AI will become one of those things where there are people who know how to use it and can work more efficiently in their job. And there will be people who don't, and they might get left behind. So it is one of those things that I really urge people to start looking into, to start working out, hey, how can it make me more efficient? And how can I just do my job a bit better?
Can you give us a couple of practical examples of, with your knowledge, where what does it look like in, say, 3 years' time, the usage of AI in our everyday lives?
So. Yeah, I think it's so much around the kind of manual, tedious tasks that a lot of us do on a day-to-day basis. How much of your job is in a spreadsheet where you're having to think, oh, what do I do here? Like when you just ask AI to do it and it's done. Writing things and, you know, getting rid of all the times that you have to write emails and reports and everything. It's just done for you. And it's like giving you the time to be more creative with your mind as to what are the big picture ideas. And once you have that big picture idea, handing off the smaller tasks to AI to kind of solve. But I also think that people tend to think that it's this like magical thing that can replace an entire job. For example, you know, there's a lot of discussion around AI taking artist jobs or taking writers' jobs, especially in Hollywood with the strikes, where movie scripts are going to magically be written by AI. I think at the moment and for the next few years, AI kind of struggles to do long form things. So it couldn't write an entire movie script for you. But you know, if you want one small scene, then it could do well with that. And I think that's where it is at the moment, especially like even when you're asking it to write code, it can't write you an entire app. Or if it does, it's not going to work very well and you're still going to need a developer to help you. It can do the pieces though. It can take away those small pieces that as a developer just makes it a lot quicker for me to do, so I don't have to keep doing it over and over again.
Someone like me, mate, being selfish, how could I be using AI more to my advantage, do you think?
It'll be interesting to see. I think there's a lot of things, even with, for example, the podcast. Mm. How much of your time goes into editing the podcast, or if you're paying someone, how much money goes into that, where you'll have AI that can just know your voice. And if you want to dub over something you've said, because you're like, oh, you know, shit, I stammered here or something, just dub over it. Done. You know, there are so many ways that we can start to like make use of it that just will add up. There's a lot more kind of, I tend to use it for a lot of development, so that's where I see it. But it's just like this mindset of, I've got a problem. Can I just get AI to like give me some hints as to how do I tackle this problem?
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised when you start getting good at like how to prompt it to get the answer out, just how much you can really get out of it.
And when you talk about getting out of it, is it mostly ChatGPT to start with, or what other things?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of ChatGPT, especially paying for the premium one, because it just is so much better. But like, yeah, you know, Google is heating up the race. And so we'll see it. You know, there's a lot of companies really trying to make their mark in the AI space. And it's such a heated space. One thing I really point out, I was having a discussion with someone the other day, is did you ever see the video a year ago of Will Smith eating spaghetti?
Oh, I saw this as a meme on social media the other day.
Basically, yeah. Right? Like of just, that's where AI generated video was a year ago. And it was just this awful thing that looks so weird. Some, you know, Twilight Universe kind of thing of like, what is this video? But then you look at OpenAI's recent announcement about Sora, the video, like text to video generator they have. And it's amazing. Like stock footage is kind of done. Like you just have it prompted and stuff. It's not perfect.
Yeah.
A year. Like
it's crazy.
A year they've made this much progress. And it's unreal.
Something that blew my mind is basically, say you wanted to get a professional photo shoot done, instead of paying for that and going and doing that and sorting out all the time and, okay, where are we going to meet? And then they'll do it, they'll edit it, it'll come back to you in 2 weeks. You gave it photos of you and then it had enough data to create better looking photos of you, and you could just pick the settings and stuff that you wanted it in.
Yeah.
And done within like 3 minutes. And this guy was basically saying, oh, I've changed all of my profile pictures to this to test and see what people say. And he's like, I've never had more people comment, be like, man, amazing bloody professional photography you've got done. Who's done that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of risk when it comes to things like photos and videos of ourselves. Yeah. We already have a problem with social media around like body image and you know, filters and things. It's like, if filters themselves are just causing that much issues, how bad is it going to be when we can just reinvent ourselves with AI? So that's an interesting space to kind of see how that like turns out. But it kind of also then brings about the idea of that there are pitfalls of AI and it can have negative effects. You know, it used to be that like video was just evidence of something happening, right? But now we're getting into the era where video is no longer going to be evidence that something happened.
Yeah, man. I see this already, where I posted the other day about Adrian Orr making some comments, basically joking about how they can print money at the Reserve Bank. And so many people are like, bro, this is fake. Like, why have you posted this? This is fake. Like, don't you know, man, this is fake. And I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then, but people were adamant that it was because they'd read somewhere that it was fake. And so then the skepticism, and I think overarching, people's trust is just going to continue to decline. And it's actually a bit of a pillar that I use under my content is how can I keep making this raw and authentic so that I can build trust? Because if I'm not a polished dude, so I can't really continue to do that. But I think the people that try and be too overly polished, it won't work anyway because people will go, something seems off with this. I think they're trying to play me. This is AI or this isn't real.
So that's a good point to bring up, because if I had advice for you, actually, that's what I would say is I think that AI is going to create such polished content that we're going to become numb to it. Mm. You know, you can just spin out thousands and thousands of articles and posts and everything that's super polished with AI just like that. So I think people would just become numb to it on social media and seeing it in your ads and everything, and will almost look for things that look more authentic, more homely, you know, someone, it's very clear that it's just someone doing it themselves rather than AI.
Yeah. Wow, fascinating, mate. Geez, we've covered some ground there at 55 minutes already. What advice would you have for Kiwis that want to learn about coding and about the internet? Is it too late for them, or what, you know, could they be focusing on if they've always wanted to scratch this itch but they've never been brave enough to have a crack at it? What would you say?
Yeah, I would say just go for it. The amount of like knowledge on YouTube around just Googling and things, it's all there. It's all online. And you have to get over yourself in a way of like, you just have to do it. You have to be, you have to embrace failure in a way. I kind of talk about like failure is almost one of the best presents you can give for yourself, because you learn so much out of it. I have a good example of when I was 20, before I started my first company, I thought I was into something huge. I'd started a company called GroupVite. And this was like when Facebook groups were kind of, or Facebook events were just becoming a big thing. And I thought, oh, there's a better way of doing this. You know, you can use an app and it'll make it all so much better. And like, I spent 6 months of my life building out a really polished app that I thought, oh my God, this is going to change how people hang out with their friends. It didn't.
Yeah.
I think I got 20 users and, you know, I spent 6 months of my life on that.
Mm.
But I learned so much in building that app. I had like an app on my resume that I could show people. And that was what actually I showed people when I then met my co-founders for my first company. They saw that, they're like, that's awesome. You know, the market's not there. The idea wasn't right, but the execution was awesome. So often I say like, just try build something. You can have an idea in mind of what you might want to build. It might be something that doesn't go anywhere, but in the act of trying to build something, you'll learn a whole lot. And so you just need to kind of almost work backwards. You have an idea of mind, like even if it's a game, like, you know, you want to build like Snake in your browser or tic-tac-toe, you know, those are good little small starting projects. How do I work backwards from, okay, here's what I want to achieve. What do I need to do that? Okay, but in order to learn how to build a website, I need to know a programming language. Okay, in order to know a programming language, what I need to know. So you kind of work backwards, take it to the beginning, and then just start from there and then work your way back up.
And people can find these sorts of resources on Google and YouTube if they start, you know, prompting the internet the right way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of paid courses online if you want, but there's also like an incredible amount of free knowledge out there. Like YouTube really is one of the best resources that we have as humans. I think like the amount of free content on there is incredible, and you can see someone just doing it from start to finish. You can watch them watch what they do, as well as then go to like coding websites that, you know, take you through courses and exercises and all that. And there's a bunch of free ones. Like Udemy and Code Academy and things, like you can go onto those, you can start to learn, and you just build it up from there. You just keep learning and learning and learning. And I'm going to be honest, to get a job, it's not the easiest thing if you've taught yourself. There's a lot to learn, but you can do it. And the tech industry is one where jobs are high paying. There's a lot of demand. You know, the market's a bit shaky at the moment, but in general, with tech going the way it is, like it's a high demand area that it's worth knowing the skill. But even if you don't want to work as a software developer, there's so much that you can get out of it of just, if you know a little bit of code, it makes you quite dangerous in your job of just how efficient you can be. You can automate things that, you know, your coworkers are taking hours to do. You can do in 5 minutes, and then guess what? You know, you've got the rest of the day off, right?
Yeah. And is there, because I'd imagine New Zealand is probably pretty far behind compared to other countries around access to developers and stuff. So, you know, I'd imagine there's big projects in New Zealand that need to happen online, but we just don't have the firepower, so we can work remotely, but internationally if we have these skills, right? And we're having to probably import this labor because we just don't have it here.
Yeah, if you look at like the Wellington Council was flying over developers to interview here because we just needed them. Like there's such high demand. It is like that kind of classic brain drain thing we have of why would you work here for a lower salary where you go work over in the US, UK, or somewhere that's paying a lot more where your salary instantly gets like 3-4x? Yeah. You know, these companies that, oh yeah, we'll do your laundry for you. We have daycare, we have gyms, we have everything like in our offices. You know, come work for us.
Mm.
As I said, the market's on a bit of a shaky ground after a lot of these big companies having layoffs and things, but overseas it's just a different scale compared to what we do here in New Zealand.
Lastly, mate, how differently do you think you see the world and what's possible in New Zealand and the world and just in general in life, given how early you got started and then learned some stuff, learned to build stuff and then exited and then brought a freehold home in your early 20s and then you're back on another journey of building something you want to scale internationally. How different do you see life compared to the ordinary Kiwi, say, and what advice do you think you could give them to look at things a little bit differently as to what's possible?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things of like, we live in a wonderful time where anyone can kind of change the world from their bedroom, right? Like, it's such an interesting thought that it's so wild that this is the world we live in, where tech almost enables all of these things to happen. And with very little resources, you can make something big happen. Mm. So I think I've always had the mindset of just like, tech can enable me to change the world. So I want to do that. I'm going to keep pushing for that no matter what. Like, I know I can, so I'm going to. And I think people could do with maybe a bit more of that mindset of just, how big can I go? We don't tend to think that in New Zealand a lot, especially, you know, we just have this small country mindset of, oh, you know, if I've got a decent, comfortable life, that's enough. And for a lot of people that is, but I think maybe challenge yourself, you know, like, get out of your comfort zone and see, what more could I do? Can I really push myself? Can I achieve more? Can I try for more? And you would be surprised at, you know, how quickly things can kind of blow up once you just start on the path of something.
Out there doing God's work, mate. I love it. I know nothing about this space, but if I just look at my own life tonight as one small example, I am hosting, say, 20 people on Zoom on a workshop. I've built a landing page with a product that they could purchase. They've input their credit card details, Stripe take the payment. That bolts into zero. I can reconcile it. Fuck knows how any of that gets built or what goes on, but I get to use it and even I can figure out how to do it. And without people like you and people that are interested in building this stuff, I can't do it. So I look at these things as tools to help me be better at what I do, but I don't need to understand the all of it, but it's amazing to know that there are people out there that are giving their life to make all of our lives better and easier through technology.
Yeah, it's exactly that. These are, at the end of the day, these are just tools. No different from when you're building a house, you need hammer and nails. And if you know how to use them, it means you can build a better house. It's as simple as that, right? Like, you know, the more tools you know, the more things you could hope to build with your business. It doesn't have to be a tech business, but it enables you to do all sorts of things.
Well, I'll do your sell for you, mate, so that you don't have to. But if I miss anything, let me know. If you are a property investor or a property manager, you need to look up Keyhook before they explode internationally and they don't have time to get back to you. But maybe Tama, the AI bot, will do that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's like, check us out. We're a radically different way of doing property management, flipping the model on its head, 1% compared to, you know, 8-12% that property managers take. I believe if you go to keyhook.com/KTC, you'll get a special offer as well.
Shit, didn't even know about this. How good. Yeah, there we go. Keyhook.com/KTC.
That's the one.
Oh, wow. Well, mate, thank you for your time and showing us a little bit of the unconventional life that you've had compared to other Kiwis. I'm inspired, mate, as always, when I catch up with you guys, and wish you massive success. And I'm sure those people listening will. If they want to keep a little bit of a closer eye on your journey, how can they do that if they want to do that?
Yeah, I mean, we're on Instagram, LinkedIn. We post quite a fair bit on LinkedIn, but we're going to be coming out with a lot more stuff soon. So, you know, just check us out and we'll be sure to fill you in.
Brilliant, mate. I'll be keeping a close eye. Cheers for your time.
Thank you for having me.